This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The National LGBTI Health Alliance held its 8th conference, Health in Difference 2013, Our Bodies, Our Minds, in Melbourne in April 2013. Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, is proud to partner with the Alliance to bring you this recording of the 2013 conference.
And the next speaker that I'd like to introduce is Morgan Carpenter. Morgan Carpenter is the Secretary of the OII Australia, a member of the AIS Support Group Australia. Morgan is a senior research analyst for a Sydney IT company and previously worked in the workers' cooperative sector in Ireland and England. Morgan moved to Australia on a 457 visa and now is a citizen and a holder of an X passport. Put your hands together for Morgan.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to me speak this morning. I'd like to give thanks to the people of the Kulin Nations on whose land we gather, and their elders past and present. I'd also like to thank Peter for the very high-level presentation that you gave, which was extraordinary. I'm going to focus more specifically on health issues, more kind of on the ground level, that will hopefully give you more clarity about our issues, and an awareness of the huge range of current actions that are taking place, some of which intersex people are working with as part of LGBTI, and others that we're working on pretty much alone. Intersex, if you haven't already grasped this, is a term that relates to a range of natural and biological traits or variations that lie between male and female. Intersex is always congenital, and it can originate from genetic, chromosomal, or hormonal variations. It's an umbrella term for a huge and diverse range of diagnoses. Although intersex people in Australia use the word intersex ourselves, the term is contested. We are regarded by medicine as having a disorder of sex development, or DSD, which affects our genitals, gonads, or chromosomes. Clinicians often typically use DSD, and some overseas patient groups often talk about differences of sex development, but that doesn't challenge the disordering when they communicate together using the same acronym. There's a consensus in Australia amongst intersex organisations to use the word intersex, and there are no DSD organisations known or active here on health and human rights issues that I'm talking about today at all in Australia. So we're medicalised, disordered, stigmatized, and suffer discrimination due to our characteristics, which affect perceptions of our realness as men or women. Intersex is not sexual orientation, and we have as diverse a range of orientations as everybody else does. Intersex is not gender identity. We have as diverse a range of gender identities as everybody else does. And any gender identity we choose for ourselves is the right one. Intersex people have non-heteronormative bodies. Our bodies do not meet social expectations. Cultural, familial, and medical attitudes govern to which sex we are assigned. Surgical and other medical interventions are made to ensure we conform to those norms, and they're made to erase intersex differences. So we're defined by what's done to us, those of our class. And we are part of the LGBTI movement because of a homophobic response to our bodies. Around 1-2% of the population may be intersex, which is comparable to the number of people with red hair. So that's a substantial number. It's not simply about people born with obvious ambiguous genitalia. There are other differences that can be discovered later in life, chromosomal differences, for example. So, in terms of health issues, every member of OII Australia, every individual intersex member, has experienced some form of non-consensual medical intervention. including pressure to conform to gender norms and be a real man or real woman, involuntary sterilization or clitorectomy as an infant, child, or adolescent, medical and familial pressure to take hormone treatment, medical and familial pressure to undertake genital normalization surgery, surgical interventions that have gone outside the terms of consent, including surgery that was normalizing without consent, and disclosure of non-relevant medical data to third parties without consent. In terms of the medical treatment of intersex children, clitorectomies, clitoral recession, and other genital surgeries are carried out unnecessarily without patient consent or regard for the full range of life paths. For example, 1 in 10 people with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, CAH, will be raised as women and go on to have a clitorectomy as an infant, but change assignment later in life. Sterilizations are typically carried out on adolescents on the basis of inflated claims of cancer risk. Some Australian medical papers quote risks of 30 to 50%, while overseas studies on for example, AIS, quote risks from 0.8 to 5%. Women with AIS typically have their testicles removed, turning them, actually most of us, into lifelong patients. But the lifetime risk that women have for breast cancer is 12.2%, and we don't routinely remove women's breasts. The impact of surgery can be seen in a high prevalence of a lack of sensation, repeat surgeries, infertility, scarring, painful intercourse, depression and trauma, and those issues are pervasive and lifelong. The rationales for surgery are often based on individual case studies, not broader evidence, and the origins of treatment protocols lie with a discredited theory by Dr. John Money from New Zealand. He developed his theory on the social construction of gender in the David Reimer case, which you might be aware of. It's a case of a boy raised as a girl after a botched circumcision. He claimed the experiment was a success when it wasn't. As a rule, research on intersex people is conducted by non-intersex clinicians based on small samples and case studies of people who have been treated by the institution conducting the study. So there's sample bias, selection bias, and there are only one or two pilot studies that look at the long term across multiple institutions. Of those, there's one by a woman called Schutzmann in 2007 that found the prevalence rates of self-harming behavior and suicidal tendencies among the intersex cohort were comparable to women with a history of physical or sexual abuse. A 2005 study of adult people treated as patients at the Royal Children's Hospital here in Melbourne, treated according to their own protocols in their own hospital, found that the intersex cohort were similarly as distressed as a comparison group of chronically somatically ill persons. That's chronically bodily ill people. So why is the surgery done? I mean, genital surgeries are done for psychosocial reasons. A normal appearance is deemed desirable to enable adjustment to society. A foundational 2006 consensus statement on intersex by a group of clinicians that coined the term DSD, defines psychosocial rationales for surgery as minimizing family concern and distress and mitigating the risks of stigmatization and gender identity confusion. Now, there has been movement on this recently. The Swiss National Advisory Commission on Biomedical Ethics apologized in November last year for past treatment and called for an end to surgery for psychosocial reasons with criminal sanction. They say, treatment needs to be carefully justified, especially since in functional, aesthetic, and psychological respects, surgically altered genitalia are not comparable to natural male or female genitalia. There is no guarantee that a decision which is good for the child in its current state will also be best for this person in puberty or adulthood. and if interventions are performed solely with a view to the integration of the child into its family and social environment, then they run counter to the child's welfare. So they say that all non-trivial sex assignment treatment decisions which have irreversible consequences, but which can be deferred, should not be taken until the person to be treated can decide for him or herself. As Peter mentioned, reporting on the 1st of February, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture talked about intersex and also about trans people and lesbians and gay men in terms of reparative treatment, reparative therapies. What the Special Rapporteur said on intersex was, children who are born with atypical sex characteristics are often subject to irreversible sex assignment, involuntary sterilization, involuntary genital normalizing surgery performed without their informed consent or that of their parents in an attempt to fix their sex, leaving them with permanent irreversible infertility and causing severe mental suffering. And they go on to describe those treatments as a form of torture. Also in February this year, the Victorian Health Department published a new framework protocol for intersex children. I thought that document was going to be available here on paper. It's not. And the Alliance, which I'm grateful, produced a letter to accompany that protocol, explaining some of the concerns with it, which I will just go on to talk about. The language in the document, this is actually the state of the art in Australia. Already, it's far better than anything that came before in Australia, but it's still got quite some way to go. The language remains medicalized, although with clinician support, not just community support, it uses the word intersex deliberately rather than disorder of sex development. What it does, though, that we find more difficult is that it references a debate about surgery for psychosocial reasons. It says, this is a quote, some advocates for intersex people now firmly argue that protection against potential psychosocial stress associated with looking different alone should no longer provide a satisfactory rationale for surgical intervention and no longer provide a basis for characterizing a treatment as therapeutic. So that's reporting the debate and our concerns rather than effecting a policy change. That is not a policy change. Irreversible surgery to make patients' genitals look consistent with the norms of their assigned gender is still the standard protocol where there is more certainty about future gender identity. And there are no cases, no intersex variations that we can think of where there is absolute certainty. So psychosocial rationales are focused on the mitigation of stigma and discrimination, but they unfairly place the burden on the intersex person to adapt. You know, looking different is a human characteristic, and different ethnic appearances, for example, are often associated with discrimination and with poor health outcomes. But we don't require people to modify their appearance as a result. We try to tackle discrimination. There are other health issues. Intersex people are terminated and there are prenatal preventative treatments now available. We have evidence of terminations on grounds of intersex going back to 1989. Arising from amniocentesis testing. And where it has been introduced in Australia for an intersex variation, it leads to a reduced number of live births. And terminations happen because intersex diagnoses are defined as genetic disorders, even though the problems with intersex bodies lie in the minds of non-intersex adults. CAH, which I mentioned before, is one variation that actually needs management. It's not an intersex variation that is purely in other people's minds. It's an adrenal condition that requires simple but lifelong treatment. But in women, it's associated with higher levels of prenatal testosterone and a degree of virilization. And that is considered to be more of a concern than adrenal insufficiency or salt wasting. In 1999, a Columbia University in the US psychologist called Heino Meyer-Balberg published a paper entitled What Causes Low Rates of Childbearing in CAH? Because CAH women are fertile. And he said, CAH women as a group have a lower interest than controls in getting married and performing the traditional childcare housewife role. As children, they show an unusually low interest in engaging in maternal play and motherhood. And he proposed that treatment with prenatal dexamethasone might cause these girls' behavior to be closer to heterosexual norms. In an analysis that shows the homophobic nature of these concerns, bioethicist Alice Drager tells how Maya Barberg and Dr. Maria New of a School of Medicine in New York published research in 2008, 5 years ago, stating, most women were heterosexual, but the rates of bisexual and homosexual orientation were increased above controls and correlated with a degree of prenatal androgenization. Drager describes in 2010 how New and a fellow pediatric endocrinologist were constructing low interest in babies and men, and even interest in what they considered to be men's occupations and games, as abnormal and potentially preventable with prenatal dex. In 2012, last year, Drager, Antonio Matis, and another person published a lengthy study on the ethics of dex, finding that US National Institutes of Health have funded New to see whether prenatal dexamethasone works to make more CAH-affected girls straight and interested in having babies. The risks are serious, despite treatment being sold to parents as safe and effective. We also have significant health issues as adults, as well as the trauma and physical issues that arise from early or non-consensual interventions. Surgery does not make us normal. Accessing adequate healthcare, other services, and even employment can be an issue for us as adults. And adults are subject to the same pressures to conform to societal and medical expectations. In my own experience, I've been pressured to take testosterone to become a real man. I've had non-consensual outcomes from one of four surgeries that I had within 4 months of each other, just a year after diagnosis. In addition to non-consensual interventions, our members have had situations where there was a failure to adequately treat an issue because only issues relating to our legal gender were considered to be relevant. We've had people declined Medicare cover for treatment considered inappropriate for someone of our legal gender. We have issues with adults. Treatments that are deemed to be aligned with our legal sex generally proceed without counseling or support, but they are as life-changing as treatments that are considered to be cross-sex treatments. Even where counseling is given, the assumptions about what is appropriate, you know, can be completely wrong. OII Australia member Michael Noble says, this is a slightly long quote, around the age of 23, an endocrinologist discovered that my body had never produced enough testosterone for me to undergo a full puberty. He therefore suggested I commence testosterone therapy. Initially, I resisted the pressures, yet eventually I crumbled under the constant onslaught of threats and horror stories of what my future would be like if I didn't undergo therapy, which doctors claimed would turn me into a real man. It was insinuated, even blatantly on occasion, that my life would be worthless, that I would be a freak, that I would never achieve my potential, and I would never have any self-esteem. Apparently, the self-esteem I already had was invalid because it existed outside the paradigm of being a real man. So at the age of 28, Michael began testosterone therapy. It generated profound and traumatic changes. I lost contact with who I was, and that's my sense of self. He was mortified with the physical changes. And he says, I lost contact with my heart and the ability to relate to people in a non-sexual manner. Worst of all was that the therapy turned me into someone I was not. Treatments that are not aligned with legal sex result in diagnosis as disordered or dysphoric. Such diagnosis is based on the inaccurate assumption that, you know, one set of gender-affirming treatments is necessarily more valid or appropriate than another. This obviously affects intersex people who have had one assignment surgically reinforced, but who later change that assignment. And numbers of people doing that vary from 8 to 40%, depending on the diagnosis. It also affects intersex people who are comfortable with their assignment. For example, a person with AIS has XY chromosomes, typically associated with being male, yet their bodies develop partially or mostly along female lines because of the different way their bodies metabolize androgens. So people with AIS will have testes rather than ovaries, but their natural appearance will generally appear like a woman, or they'll be raised as women and generally feel like they're women. If their testes are retained, women with AIS can avoid any need for HRT and will go through a natural female puberty, developing female characteristics. But when they're sterilized, women with AIS are not offered a nature-identical hormone replacement to that their body's produced. Because they are women, they are offered estrogen, the hormone produced by ovaries. Women with AIS who wish to replace the hormone they used to produce with a nature-identical hormone, testosterone, are thought to have gender identity issues. The Senate is currently conducting an inquiry on sterilization and the sexual health of people with disabilities, and it's also conducting the same inquiry for intersex people. There were submissions to that inquiry by OAI Australia and by the AAS support group, and also by the National LGBTI Health Alliance. The submissions and transcripts from a hearing in March are well worth reading if you want to find out more about the intersex experience. And we detail much more about what I've talked about so far. What we're trying to do is reframe the debate, trying to consider intersex as a human rights issue. And I should also mention in that context, a Senate report on the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill last year. Submissions were last year. The report was published in February. That, for the first time in Australia, says that intersex is a biological characteristic and should be covered by a separate attribute, intersex status. We think that language is great, as it helps to change how the debate about us is framed and how we're talked about. Identity regulations, which is an issue that we kind of share with trans people, are much lower on our list. For example, X passports have been available for 10 years because a Victorian Alex McFarlane challenged the Howard government in 2002 on the basis of Alex's non-specific Victorian birth certificate. Intersex people in the eastern states can change their birth certs on the basis of an administrative error at birth. So, you know, what do we want? We want respectful treatment that is based on actual, not assumed need, on our actual bodies, not those of our assumed gender. We want a society where issues of gender and sexuality are not problematized, because that's the cause of our issues. In terms of our place in LGBTI, we would like lesbians, gay men, and trans people not to extrapolate our experience or needs from your own experience or needs. We would like you to know more about us and our needs so that you can talk about them from a place of understanding. Adding the I onto LGBT is not just about changing your language, it's also about changing your frame of reference to include us. You know, we experience homophobia differently, not because of our identities, but because of our bodies. You know, we belong here. And we want to be included, but please include us on the basis of what you understand properly about us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Morgan. Who would like to ask the panel some questions?
Yes, good morning. I'd like to say to the panel, thank you very much for opening dialogues that I think are drastically needed to understand all three areas that you've covered. To Peter, I would like to say, as one trans activist and advocate to another, I salute you for what you're doing. Please continue.
Next, please.
I'll try to be brief. I knew when I came in this morning, knowing the people on the panel are people I love and admire so much, it was going to be good, but you've exceeded my expectations infinitely. I'll try to keep it brief. There's so much going through my head and heart at the moment after that. It's hard. It is really hard to do that. But I have to say, similar to what Kathy said, Peter, someone once said, leaders don't create more followers, they create more leaders. God damn it, you're a leader. that was just awesome. The only thing I wanted to add to it, which I can't quite get the words into a question, but something happened after those of us who were privileged enough to be at the foundation of what became the Diversity in Health booklet, those who were leaving Sydney and flying home, were sitting around the airport lounge having a soft drink. And a lot of us there, intersex, trans, gender, queer, were saying, well, we're sort of getting somewhere, but that B isn't, that bisexual. And I'd planned to do this afternoon as recommendations, but I feel my heart says I've got to put it up now. I'd ask the Alliance in the next short to medium term to consider doing what it has done for seniors and for intersex, trans and genderqueer, for bisexual, pansexual, because I feel now if we are getting some sort of strength, we have to pass that on, the same as the good gays and lesbians, if I can use such a term, have passed that on to us. And yes, I totally acknowledge what you've said. So I suppose if I can try to formulate a question out of all of that, what can we do? Can we just get some starting thoughts on how we might have that debate? And also, I suppose the other question, how do we keep the debate safe about having this debate about the double standards under the rainbow that you touched on as well? So there's my two questions. And it's to all three of you.
On bisexuality, I think bisexuality is like the gender diversity of sexuality in some ways. It's the third of those areas that doesn't get much thought. I identify as queer, and there's a new term which I really love as well called sapiosexual. And I would like that to come into more widespread usage. I think that it would be good if the Alliance could spend more time looking at diversity of sexual orientation outside the binary, for the same reasons that it's good to look at gender diversity separate to trans.
I'm Mish Pony. I'm the trans sex work representative for Scarlet Alliance, the Australian Sex Workers Association. I suppose this question is for Peter, but anyone can have a go. There's a lot of writing and theory that's come out of North America and more recently South America about the intersection of sex work legislation and the health and well-being and citizenship of trans women. What's your opinion of this and how it translates to an Australian context?
Mish, I don't think I can answer your question. I don't think I'm really... I don't have the experience or understanding to go there.
I just wanted to talk about toilets because I understand very much from what I've heard the importance of having toilets like they've been labelled here today, so there's not male and female. But I just wanted to also make the point that for a lot of lesbians, mixed toilets can be unsafe places, in fact, for a lot of women. So I was just concerned that if there's the idea that public toilets generally... that I'm talking about in terms of sexual assault and one in four women being sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So I just wanted to make that point that there is some concern, I think, about women going into toilets that might be mixed and how safe that might be.
On the toilets issue, OIR Australia, we were very conscious during the human rights and discrimination submission process that intersex had not been properly thought through by the Attorney General's Department, partly because of a fear that talking about intersex would create a third sex, and if you have a third sex, well, what toilet do you use? So we had to put quite a bit of thought into what that meant, and I completely accept the issues that you raised, Peter, about safety and safe spaces and your own experience. But, even if we somehow create a third arbitrary sex box category, then that doesn't create any more regulatory impact than we already have in Australia, because there are premises standards under subsection 31(1) of the Disability Discrimination Act that already make provision for unisex accessible toilets as well as male and female toilets. So those standards require a unisex accessible toilet wherever there is a male and female toilet block. So toilets are one of those, you know, big fear questions people have, but the answers, you know, lie in our own hearts and also in the regulations that the government has already put in place for disability. So, to my mind.
I would just like to formally thank all of our speakers this morning that have talked about some amazing issues. Can you please put your hands together for Morgan Carpenter?
You have been listening to a recording from the Health Indifference 2013 conference held in Melbourne in April 2013. For more information about the National LGBTI Health Alliance, head to lgbtihealth.org.au. And for more information on Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, explore joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.